How's everybody doing? Good, relatively good. That's better than relatively bad. Doing all right. So this is what I want to do today. Have a word of prayer, do a little review, read some Bible, and then go out and do something important. Sound good? Cool. You do go out and do something important after this, right? Okay. Yeah. I don't want this just to be humdrum. So anyway, first of all, word of prayer. So the Lord be with you. Let us pray. Blessed Lord, who has caused all scriptures to be written for our instruction, teach us so to hear them, to read, mark, learn, and inwardly digest them, so that we may embrace and ever hold fast the blessed hope of everlasting life that you have given to us through our Lord Jesus Christ, to whom with you and the Holy Spirit be all honor and glory, world without end. Amen. Beautiful. Little review. Last week we dealt with Elijah. We're talking about Elijah, right? I'm just getting closer because of the noise in the hall, so I will. I'll get closer to you. No, I won't get that close. It's not the gospel. It's just Second or First Kings. Yeah, last week we dealt with Elijah, and you remember what happened last week? Anybody? Anybody? Huh? No, that was not last week. Anybody remember what happened last week? Mountain? Carmel? Mount Carmel? Fire? Right, okay, cool. Awesome, excellent. Now that everybody knows. What we did last week, right, is that God told Elijah that I'm going to send, enough of your whole drought thing, I'm going to send rain, right? And so what you need to do is you need to go show yourself to Ahab, King Ahab. And you remember Ahab, right? He has a wife named, everybody knows that. Sure, Jezebel, right? And Jezebel, she's not nice, right? And so Elijah goes to present himself to Ahab. He finds Obadiah, the servant of Ahab. Elijah says to Obadiah, go tell your king, go tell Ahab that I'm here and I want to see him. And you remember what Obadiah does? He goes off and see, no, he doesn't, right? He says, absolutely not. I'm not going to do that, right? This is Elijah, right? Absolutely not. I'm not going to do that. If I go off and I tell Ahab that you're here, then what you're going to do, you're going to go God knows where. Who knows what you're going to do? To be quite blunt, you can't be trusted. God knows what you're going to do, and then Ahab's going to try to find you, and you're not going to be here, and then he's going to kill me. And so you're putting my life in danger, and so what in the heck do you think you're doing? Absolutely not. I'm not going to tell him that. It's kind of a funny response, right? That's not what I'm expecting from the prophet of God, again, and what all of these stories about Elijah, as we saw a few semesters ago with Samuel, right? What these stories with prophets do is that they're not actually very simple stories. And in fact, the story today is it's going to complicate things even more. They're not simple stories. They in fact show that the figure of a prophet, a prophetic figure, a figure of a prophet is actually kind of a troublesome thing. And not just troublesome because they're telling me that I need to clean up my life and I don't want to clean up my life and I want to be sinful and I want... It's not troublesome that way. It's just troublesome in a very deep way. And that is, it's never quite clear who speaks for God. Right? It's never quite clear. And so it's really tough with all of these. And again, as I always say, you just turn on late night religious programming. And I mean, we have the same thing now. You don't even need to turn on religious programming. You just need to turn on the news, right? And again, we have people speaking for God all the time now around the world, as well as just in the United States. And it's tough, right? I mean, it's tough knowing who's speaking the truth? It's almost as if we need some sort of a, I don't know, a criterion. Something that we do trust, that has proven trustworthy, that we can take these ephemeral, quotidian, day-to-day people and not judge them by, but put them in comparison with this criterion, this standard, so that we can make some sort of decision about who speaks for God or not. I'll talk about that in just a second. So eventually, Elijah shows up to Ahab, right? And Elijah essentially says, call all Israel to Mount Carmel, right, which is a mountain in northern Israel. Call all Israel to Mount Carmel because we're gonna have a showdown, right? And so Ahab does that. He calls all Israel. He calls all Israel. He calls all Israel. That's really important. He calls all Israel to come to Mount Carmel. All Israel is called to Mount Carmel, as well as the 400 prophets of Baal, 450 prophets of Baal, 400 prophets of Asherah, the goddess. So they're there too. And all Israel is there, and there's going to be a contest. And it's a contest between Elijah on the one hand and all of these foreign prophets on the other. Elijah obviously representing God, and all of these obviously foreign prophets representing, well, Baal and Asherah. And Israel is going to be the jury. And Elijah tells them the way things are going to work. They're going to make two altars. They're going to make two sacrifices. They're not going to set fire to the sacrifice. And they're going to call on their gods. And the God that answers by fire, whatever the heck that might mean, I don't know what that means in the midst of the story, but the God that answers by fire is the true God. And all Israel says, yeah, that sounds good. So they do that. The prophets of Baal and Asherah start early in the morning. All day long they call out to Baal. All day long they call out to Baal. All day long they call out to Baal. And nobody answers. Nobody responds. Duh. As if I was expecting a response, right? Again, I've read the Bible up to this point. I kind of not, you know, no what to expect, right? Nobody responds. Elijah repairs the altar, sets up the sacrifice, pours water on it, which is not something you normally do with a sacrifice, pours water on it. And then all he doesn't pronounce a pronouncement, he doesn't produce an oracle, he doesn't do some sort of magical stuff. All Elijah does is pray. That's all he does. He just prays. And his prayer is essentially this. Thank you. All I want you to know, all I want these people to know, is that I am your prophet, spokesperson. All I want these people to know is that I am your servant and that I've done all of this according to your word. And I only want these people to know, and this is what's interesting about the end of his prayer. All I want these people to know is that you have already turned their hearts back to you. Even before the miracle, you have already turned their hearts back to you. Bam! Fire falls from the sky, consumes the sacrifice, the altar, laps upon the water. Boom! Israel sees that and says, I'm still not sure. No, they don't say that. All Israel sees that and says, Yahweh, Yahweh's God. Yahweh is God. Let me ask you a question. Who says Yahweh is God? Two or three people in Israel? A couple of dozen? All Israel. All Israel says Yahweh is God. This is the way in which prophets are, at least it's been set up, this is the way that prophets are supposed to work. is that we see a sign and we are drawn into a, remember, and again, it's going to be something I'm going to harp on basically from now on to May. We are drawn into a more committed devotion to God. We aren't split up. Our loyalties aren't divided. We're focused on the love of God. And obviously, as Christians, the love for others, because it's the same thing. The love of God. We're focused on that. Soon after that confession, the rain comes. And we end the chapter with Elijah and Ahab. Whenever all Israel, and again, you yourself said all Israel proclaims that Yahweh is God. Yes? That's what it says. It really does. Is Ahab a part of that? Yes, he's part of Israel. Well, he's the king. I certainly hope he's part of Israel. Ahab himself confesses Yahweh is God. We end the chapter. The drought is ended. All of Israel recognizes who the true God is. There are no more, a little thing I just slipped over, all the prophets of Baal and Asherah got killed. But anyway, let's not dwell on that. There are no more foreign prophets. All of Israel knows who God is. All the people are unified, and all of the people are unified in their devotion to God. Awesome. Finally. God, I wish it lasted. Oh my gosh. I wish it lasted. So anyway, we're going to take a look at what we have today. Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done and how he had killed all the prophets. That is, the foreign prophets, not Yahweh prophets, obviously. The prophets with the sword. These are her prophets. And notice what she does. She sends somebody to kill Elijah. She goes ahead and just wipes him out. She just goes ahead and takes care of him. Remember, she's been killing the prophets for a long time, the prophets of Yahweh. She's been killing them for a long time. And notice what she does. She hears that Elijah has killed all of her prophets, so she goes and she kills Elijah. No, she doesn't do that. Notice what she does. It's really interesting what she does. She hears that Elijah has killed all of her prophets, and then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah saying, "So may the gods do to me and more also if I don't make your life like the life of one of them by this time tomorrow." That's a threat. And it's a threat that's based on an oath, right? "So may my gods punish me if I don't make your life," blah, 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 right? In poker, this is what we say, she's just shown her hand. Because you see, if she could kill Elijah, she would just do it. She's killed prophets before. But you see, she's actually shown her hand. She has no support. You see, her husband, the king, has confessed his loyalty to God alone. All of Israel has confessed their loyalty to God alone. There are no more prophets, her prophets. You see, she's all alone. There is no one else in Israel that worships Baal. And the only thing that she can do is make a threat. An empty threat, in fact. You see, things are the way that they are supposed to be. And you see what Elijah does in the face of this threat. Absolutely. He ignores it and goes back and serves the people, making sure that their devotion to God is centered up. Absolutely. God, what a wonderful leader. Oh, no, that's not what he does. I'm sorry. He was afraid, right? And again, there's no racking, as we would say when I was a child in cartoons, there is no racking, fracking reason why he should be afraid. But he's afraid. And he got up and he fled for his life. You understand that there is actually no threat. The story is set up so that there is no threat. But he fears, he runs away for his life, and he comes to Beersheba, which is in the south of Jerusalem. It's right there on the edge of the wilderness, which belongs to Judah. So he leaves Israel, he goes to Judah, he leaves Judah, he goes to Beersheba, he leaves his servant there. He himself goes a day's journey into the wilderness, and he came down and he sat under a solitary tree. On Mount Carmel, he was one with all of Israel. They were all devoted to Yahweh. He's left his country, he's gone to another country, he's left that country, he's gone to a town, he's left that town, left his servant there, gone out by himself in the wilderness, and now he's under a solitary tree. He's totally alone. For no reason. And he asked that he might die, which is the stupidest thing in the world. Because if he actually wanted to die, he could have stayed in Israel, and Jezebel, by her own threat, could have taken care of that for him. He doesn't want to die. He's running away for his life. But he says, "Oh, it's enough now, O Lord, take away my life. I'm no better than my ancestors." He's all depressed because he's not better than the ancestors. Which seems to assume that he should be better than his ancestors. Or there's some sort of an expectation that he should be better than his ancestors. He should be more important than his ancestors. And he's not more important than his ancestors, and so his life is basically worthless. You understand where he was just in the last chapter. He lay down under the tree and he fell asleep. So he's in the middle of the wilderness. Suddenly an angel. Okay, we'll go with it. It's the word messenger here. Suddenly an angel. When I say angel, what do you think of? Oh, come on. What do you think of? Wings, halos, golden hair, beautiful white dress, even though he's a male, right? So anyway, right? That's what you... But it's not the word angel here. It's just the word messenger. Suddenly a messenger. Let's go with this. And because it produces a bit more ambiguity, right? Suddenly a messenger touched him. Oh, maybe this is the messenger from Jezebel, right? That was before. Touched him and said to him, "Get up and eat." And he looked, and there at his head was a cake. A cake baked on hot stones and a jar of water. We've seen the cakes before in our story. I mean, not this one, obviously, because we just started this one. But we've seen cakes before. Remember where we had cakes before? Where? With the widow. That's right. The widow. You remember what she did? She made cakes for Elijah, right? And herself and her son. She made cakes. And you remember what she also gave him to drink. She gave him water. And you see, so here, yet again, he's being taken care of here by a messenger, right? Get up, and what do you know? There's a cake, and there's a jar of water, and he ate and he drank. Then he went back to sleep. Well, this story isn't really going anywhere, is it? The messenger comes again, second time, touches him, and says, "Get up and eat." And here, I wish I had changed this. This is the way, yet again, this is the way the NRSV translates this. Otherwise, the journey will be too much for you. And it really doesn't say that in Hebrew. I understand why they want it to say that, because they see Elijah as this hot stuff guy, this wonderful guy. But it really doesn't say that. What it says is something in Hebrew. What it says is something like, "Get up and eat," because journey is pushing it a bit, because your way of life is good enough. Your lifestyle is sufficient. Get up and eat, because what you're supposed to be doing It's enough. It's good. So in other words, get up, eat, and then get back and start doing what you're supposed to be doing. So he got up and he ate and he drank, and he went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights. In the wilderness, eating, drinking, being provided 40 days, 40 nights. We just heard it. Actually, it's kind of ironic that we're dealing, again, I don't plan these things. It's actually ironic because we actually heard in church this morning, Moses on the mountain, and he's up there for how long? 40 days and 40 nights. He's on the mountain, and the mountain that he's on is Mount Sinai. It's also called Horeb. He goes in that strength, 40 days and 40 nights, until he comes to, oh, what a coinky-dinky, Horeb. It's almost as if he's thinking that he might be, oh, I don't know, Moses. And at that place, he came to a cave, and he spent the night there. And then the word of the Lord came to him saying, okay, I'm going to interpret this for you by the way I read it. What are you doing here, Elijah? I sent a messenger to you to feed you so that you can get back to what it is, right? I mean, all of Israel, it was the fire of God that, again, God's not unaware what happened on Carmel. I mean, God's not like, wasn't like on a cruise somewhere with coronavirus or something and is completely out of touch, right? I mean, God knows what had happened in the previous scene, right? What are you doing here in the big middle of nowhere at my mountain? Get off my lawn, right? What are you doing here, Elijah? And he answered, I've been very zealous for the Lord of hosts, the God of hosts, but the Israelites have forsaken your covenant, they've thrown down your altars, they've killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they're seeking my life to take it away. See, the problem is that when you read this story the way the lectionary sets it up, you don't know what happened in the previous scene. And so you just go right along with Elijah. Or absolutely, you know what? He alone is left because all of Israel has forsaken God, they've torn down the altars, and they've killed God's prophets. Let me ask you a question. Have they done any of that? Exactly the opposite. In fact, at Carmel, and this is the reason why I stressed it, all Israel was united in their devotion to God. The only person in the entire country that isn't is Jezebel. She's the one that has forsaken God. In fact, she's never devoted to God. She's the one that has killed God's prophets. She's the only one. It's almost as if Elijah thinks that because Jezebel wants to kill him, everybody wants to kill him. It's almost as if Elijah thinks that he's Israel. And he said, go out and stand on the mountain. That is, God said, go out and stand on the mountain before the Lord, because the Lord is about to pass by. You see how I have indented this little section? And you see, after that section, it says, when Elijah heard. And again, I should have changed this. When, and again, I just checked it right before class. When Elijah heard it, you see that? You see the it? The it's not there in Hebrew. It just says, when Elijah heard, he wrapped his face in his mantle and went and stood at the entrance of the cave. Okay, so far so good? Because if you put the it in there, what it seems as though the it refers to that little section that I've indented. Because a lot of stuff is going to be going on. And again, we'll go back to it. We're not going to ignore it, right? But it's almost as if what happens, and again, if you just take out that little, and again, we'll go back to it. I'm not going to, but if you take out that little thing, what it says is, what are you doing here, Elijah? Oh my God, everybody's trying to kill me. Everybody hates me. Nobody likes me. Everybody hates me. I guess I'll eat some worms. Right? Oh, I'm the only one and they're trying to kill me. And he said, go out and stand on the mountain with the Lord, because the Lord is about to pass by. And when Elijah heard, he wrapped his face in his mantle and he went out and he stood at the entrance of the cave. You see how it fits together? You see that? So it fits together. What are you doing here? Ooh, everybody hates me. Go out and stand before the Lord. He obeys the command. And then a voice comes to him saying, what are you doing here, Elijah? And he said the exact same thing. I'm all alone. Everybody wants to kill me. Right? So far, so good? You see how it works? What are you doing here? Complaint. Do something. He does it. What are you doing here? Complaint. See how it works? In the middle of all, and again, think about Hebrew. And again, in this class, lots of times I've talked about Hebrew words. Well, I've just done it in this class. Oh, it doesn't really say that in Hebrew. It says blah, 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 blah. And you just have to trust me with that. Or you don't have to trust. You can do whatever you want to, actually. Actually, you're free agents. But another aspect of Hebrew that's a little bit more, not complicated, but another, unlike English, I'll tell you this, is that there isn't tense. There isn't tense in Hebrew, right? So whenever I say, for example, the verb ran. So far, so good. Do you know who ran? Do you know when that action occurred? Yes, you know it's in the past tense, right? You know it happened before now, right? Watch. Will talk. There's a verb. Do you know who is going to talk? Do you know when that action, right, it's going to occur in the future, right? English, we mark our verbs for tense. Hebrew doesn't mark their verbs for tense. And again, people can run with that and do a lot of stuff with it. Most of the time, it's very clear. But the neat thing is that what that means in Hebrew is that you can have things happening at the same time. At the same time. At the same exact time. And again, it's tough for us to do this in English because we have to say things like, this all was happening at the same time as X, Y, and Z. So far, so good. But in Hebrew, you can just fiddle with the verbs just a little bit, and you can make something happening at the same time as something else. Does that kind of make sense? Kind of, right? This little indentation block is happening at the same time as all of this other stuff. What are you doing here, Elijah? Oh, I've been blah, 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 blah. You need to go out and stand. So he goes out, he wraps his mantle, right? He goes out, what are you doing here, Elijah? Oh, everybody hates me. So far, so good. While all of that is happening, at the same time, this is also happening. There's a great wind, right? Because he's up on Sinai, and again, we saw it this morning, right? In the Exodus, right? He's up there, right? And there's a cloud, and there's fire, and there's smoke, and there's earthquakes, and there's all this stuff going on the top of Horeb. Of course, because you know who lives up there, right? There was a great wind, so great that it was splitting mountains and breaking rocks in pieces before the Lord. But the Lord wasn't in the wind. And after the wind, there was an earthquake. But the Lord's not in the earthquake. There's a fire. The Lord's not in the fire. And after that, there's just silence. It's kind of funny. You remember in the last scene? And again, I was thinking about this on the drive into church today. One of the things that I wish that I could convince people of about the Bible, and that it wasn't written for children. It was written for real adults that actually live in the real world. And that there are views in the Bible that are different from other views. Remember what happened in the previous scene? All Israel standing around. Elijah does what he does. He prays. You remember what happens? Yeah, what happens? Fire! Fire comes down. Woo! Licks up everything. And you remember what Israel does when they see the fire? Ooh, Yahweh's the one that's God. Yahweh's the one that's God. Because they see a sign, they believe. Because they see something, That provides the basis for their faith. Here we are at Horeb, and there's wind, there's an earthquake, there's fire, and God's not really associated with any of it. I don't know if you know this. I don't know if you've been paying attention to the news, but like Australia, you know? I don't know if you know this, but you can actually have a fire and it not be a manifestation of God's presence. Right? Or you can have a wind and it not be a manifestation of God's presence. You can have an earthquake and it not be because God caused it. Or it was a sign because of God's... The whole thing with signs, the tricky thing is that sometimes they just happen. Even on Horeb. David Hume, a famous Scottish philosopher of the late 1700s, early 1800s, he has a great book. And in it, it's a critique of religion. He was an agnostic, maybe atheist. And it's a great, it really is a really good critique of religion about what's wrong with religion. And one of the things, according to Hume, says that what's wrong with religion is that people base things on signs. He says, even if you're standing there and you hear a voice from heaven saying, "Oh, I don't know, this is my son, the beloved, with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him." You have no idea where that voice is coming from. It doesn't provide a basis for faith. Now, if you have faith, you're going to hear it in certain ways. But it doesn't provide a basis. It's kind of interesting. I mean, it's kind of an adult thought. Right? I mean, this is certainly not something you're going to hear preached from the pulpit here, right? But we're all adults here, and we all know that people can see things and hear things and do things on a relation as a response to those things, that sometimes those things that they do and those things that they believe, well, let's just say aren't very helpful. It's kind of interesting. What are you doing here, Elijah? Oh, everybody hates me. Nobody likes me. Everybody's trying to kill me. Huh? I'm going to eat dirt. That's right, exactly. Yeah. It's very clear that whatever it is that Elijah... Again, he's just had his highest... He's done what he's supposed to do. Everything's great. It's not just great. It's the way in which things are supposed to be, and Elijah's the cause of that. Does Elijah want to do this anymore? No. Just like Jonah. I don't... So God gives him one more assignment. You don't want to do this anymore? Okay. This is the last thing you have to do. This is the last thing you have to do. Go. Go back to Damascus, that is in Syria. And when you arrive, you anoint Hazael as king over Aram. There's a guy now called Ben-Hadad who's the king. And God says, Elijah, you're supposed to go up there and cause them to have a new king. And also, you're supposed to come back to Israel. Ahab is obviously the king now. You come back to Israel and you anoint Jehu, the son of Nimshi, as king over Israel. And then finally, what you need to do is that you need to anoint Elisha, the son of Shaphat of Abel-Meholah, as a priest in your place. I'm sick and tired of you. Yeah. So we're going to get somebody else in there that can maybe actually do something and actually knows what this is all about. And the reason why we're going to set it up this way is that whoever escapes from the sword of Hazael, Jehu is going to kill. Whoever escapes from the sword of Jehu, Elisha shall kill. And again, what the language that's being used here is of justice, right? So those who flout justice or those who don't do what they're supposed to do we can take care of them. And you notice how Syria, Israel, and Elisha, the prophet, are all working together, right? So there's harmony. So we're going to try to set this up again. You're obviously, things are going pretty well right now, but you don't want to be a part of it. That's fine and dandy. So we're going to set this thing up again, and we're going to try to get harmonious vision going on here again. And in fact, I'm going to leave 7,000 people in Israel. You know. Oh yeah, you're all alone. I know you're not all alone. I was actually there at Carmel, right? I was the one that actually sent the fire, right? I know what went on there. I'm going to leave 7,000 people in Israel, all those knees that haven't bowed to Baal, all those mouths that haven't kissed him. I know that you're not alone, but because you think you're all alone, enough of you. We're going to get this story. Things are in a good place now. We need to get things moving, right? Strike while the iron's hot, right? And so he set out from there, and he went to Syria, and he anointed Hazael as king over Syria, and then he came down to Israel, and he anointed Jehu as king over Israel, and then he doesn't do any of that. He's so sick that the only thing he wants to do is find his replacement and get out of there. He just goes and finds Elisha. He set out from there, he found Elisha, the son of Shaphat. And he's not even a prophet. He's not even doing prophetic, he's not even among the sons of, he's a plowboy. He's plowing. There were 12 yoke of oxen ahead of him, and he was with the 12th. And Elijah passed by him and threw his mantle, and again, here I actually did change it, and you can see it. Again, the NRSV says he threw his mantle over him. So that's so touching. He takes his mantle off and he goes up to the young man, casts it over him, taking on the mantle of the man of God. The prophet has passed on his office to one who is worthy. He doesn't do that. And the verb, there's a perfectly good verb. Preposition. Perfectly good preposition in Hebrew meaning over. It's not that. It's the verb, or it's the preposition at. He takes off his mantle and throws it at Elisha. He just throws it at him, toward him, over in that direction. He just takes it off and throws it. Does he anoint him? Just notice that there, all of these instructions, he doesn't do any of them from God. He finds Elisha, takes off his mantle, throws it at him. Elisha let the oxen. Again, you notice Elijah keeps moving. He's not there. Again, it's not a ceremony. He takes it off, throws it at him, and he just keeps walking. Excuse me, sir, you dropped your coat, right? He runs after him. He leaves the oxen. He runs after him, and he said, "But just let me kiss my father and my mother, and then I will follow you." It seems as though Elisha seems to see that situation as somehow a calling or a, I don't know. Yeah, a calling, right? Leave your nets and follow me or something like this. But there's no words. Just throws it at him. But he sees it as some sort of a calling. Let me kiss my father and my mother and then I will follow you. And Elijah said to him, and it's, he says two things and both of them are ambiguous. He either says go or come back again. So either go back again or come back again. It's either as if, yeah, go ahead and kiss your father and mother and then come back and follow me and I will make you fishers of men. Go and then come back and, you know, and we can take this as, or forget you, just go back. I don't want anything to do with you. So it's ambiguous that way. And then it's like, what have I done to you? What have I done to you? I haven't done anything. I threw my coat at you. I haven't done anything. Or is it, well, you understand what I've done. I'm not quite sure which it is. But I am sure how Elisha hears it. Because the way in which Elisha hears it is, go back and then return, because I've done something important to you. And you notice what Elisha does. He goes back and he kisses his father and his mother, and then he comes back and follows. No, he doesn't. Right? That's what he said. Let me go back and kiss my father and mother. Notice that he doesn't do that. He goes back, he slaughters the oxen, he barbecues them, he makes a party for everyone, and everybody gets to eat. And then he follows Elijah and becomes the prophet of Israel. No. See, I've been with you so long, you know not to trust me. Which is wonderful, right? No, he doesn't follow him and become the new prophet. He follows him as his servant. He becomes his servant. It's an interesting thing for Elisha. We haven't met Elisha. This is the very first time we've met Elisha. It's an interesting thing because Elisha says he wants to kiss his father and mother, but he doesn't do that. But the thing that he does is that he feeds people. Whenever, again, and we're going to spend a couple of Sundays with Elisha, and it's funny is that one of the things that Elisha's going to do, he's kind of cut out of the same mold as Elijah. And we'll see this over and over and over. He's not really someone that you can really trust. On the other hand, unlike Elijah, he's someone that feeds. He takes care. When people have no resources, when people have nothing, he'll take care of them. He'll give them things. He'll provide food for them. I mean, miraculously. He uses his power to take care of people. And like Elijah, that power eventually comes home to roost with Elisha. How convenient. So he's going to be both cut out of the same mold, as well as he's going to be a little bit different. So anyway, whoo! Well, finally, we're done. Done with Elijah. No, we're not done with Elijah. We end the story. Well, in fact, the next chapter, just really quickly, the next chapter has nothing to do with Elijah or Elisha. It has to do with a war. And it's a war between Israel and Syria. You remember the king of Syria? It's Ben-Hadad. You remember the king of Israel? It's Ahab. And those two kings fight a war in which many people die. You remember what God told Elijah to do? Does he do it? No. And because of that, because of his disobedience, what once was so wonderful, so perfect, so pristine, so devoted, so unified, yet again, it's falling apart. But I'm sure that Elisha's going to put it back together. All right, that's all. Thank you.